تو دنیا پیدا نمیشه، گل تو دنیا پیدا نمیشه. آرا وای 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 آرا وای 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 آرا وای 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 آرا وای 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 وای.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for the Wall Street Journal. He was also a senior fellow for Middle East Affairs at the Council on Foreign Relations. In 2003, he formed the consulting company Strategic Energy Information Group in Dubai. And your neighborhood there in the Gulf, Yusuf, is getting very tense today after the entrance of Saudi troops. Yesterday, Iran has lashed out at Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. And, of course, there's been a substantial demonstration at the Saudi embassy where people were peacefully protesting and putting flowers in the gates. But clearly the Bahrainis are not happy with the arrival of the Saudis. Do you think this has the potential for escalating into some kind of broader surrogate confrontation or conflict between Saudi and Iran?
Yes, most definitely. But it's important to clarify that those Bahrainis who are very unhappy with the Saudi invasion, for lack of a better description, are the Shiite Bahrainis, who represent 70% of the population in that country, which is nevertheless ruled by a Sunni minority, a tribe that basically invaded the place 200 years ago.
And these are not Iranians. They're Arab Shiites. So I don't understand why Saudi Arabia and the king of Bahrain are engaging in sectarian divisions. I spoke with a reporter for the only independent newspaper in Bahrain recently, and she said that there's no question that, it, to her mind, that the regime is exacerbating tensions between the Sunni minority and the Shia majority, and they're spreading all kinds of anti-Shia hate on state television.
Yes, but that is not true. That is not new. It's been true for as long as the Bahraini tribe, which has declared itself a kingdom, took over the island. Basically, it originates, the current ruler, who has become a king, originates from the same branches and structure of the leading and ruling tribes of Saudi Arabia, which, of course, are supremely led by the Al Saud family, hence the name Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, as it stands, is the harder nut of the hard nuts of Islamic fundamentalist thinking and theology in the Muslim world, as opposed to the more secular version of Islam, Sunni Islam in places like Egypt and Indonesia. But it is definitely an arch enemy of the other branch of Islam, which is Shia Islam. And its grand religious theological leaders and schools of thinking, which are closely allied with the royal family since the establishment of Saudi Arabia, take it as an article of faith. The Shiites are, in fact, infidels, on a notch below, actually, Christians and Jews, which they refer to, whom they refer to as sons of pigs and monkeys.
So are they prepared then, since they have the Saudis have a huge Shiite majority in the very area where the oil fields are, and if they are the tail that wags the dog in terms of the Bahraini royal family, and I understand the massacre that took place some time back in Pearl Square was either initiated by Saudi special forces or the king was pressured into it. So the Saudis are taking a hard line whether this king wants to follow Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates's advice that these small steps towards reform aren't going to make it. So,
yeah, he called them baby steps.
Baby steps, right?
But the fact of the matter, Ian, and the bigger picture is, we, the United States of America, have actually made a choice, and we made it very, very clearly, to stand by those regimes which are in the process of being challenged by their people. You remember, Ian, very clearly that the President Obama and the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, only days before Hosni Mubarak was forced to leave Egypt, referred to him as a stable ruler and a friend of the United States, and to Egypt as a stable regime. As a matter of fact, the envoy of Obama, Ambassador Frank Wisner, who went to see Mubarak, came out of that meeting saying, you know, he thinks Mubarak ought to finish his current term, which ended 2013. In the same time, we clearly stand by Saudi Arabia, and we clearly stand by the King of Bahrain. Now, when we started rethinking this barely a day or two before the popular revolution triumphed in Tunisia and the popular revolution triumphed in Egypt, we began to change our tune, saying, you know, we believe in democracy and the rule of the people and reforms. We've been saying the same thing about Saudi Arabia for 20 years, but we don't really insist on it. So basically, we make our choices depending on our strategic interest. And our strategic interest really hasn't been with the little people of Tunisia or the little people of Egypt. And at this point, we don't really have a new policy on how to deal with the Egyptian revolution and the Tunisian revolution. And we most certainly do not have a policy on how to deal with the Libyan revolution. And you would think on this one, our position ought to be crystal clear. I mean, Muammar Gaddafi is going to have a very hard time to find a single person who actually receives him in their country after this. And yet, we haven't had a position on this. So basically, our position seems to be motivated by stability related to oil supplies.
Well, but isn't it reached a point now where you're talking in general about our foreign policy tradition of realpolitik, Yusuf Ibrahim, and it would seem that we're reaching an era now where acting according to our ideals may end up being more pragmatic than acting in our so-called interests. And I'm just astounded if Gates tried to advise this king to get with reform in a real way, and I imagine if we dare advise the Saudis to do the same thing, they don't listen to us. But frankly, it would seem that unless the Saudi royals start treating their own people a little better, and particularly the minority people, the Shiites, who now apparently they're going to inflame, they're going to go down in flames.
Not only their Shiites, I mean, they have a lot of young people among their crushing majority Sunni population, who have long ago broken from this royal family, which is basically, the youngest person in line for the throne is 80 years old. The current king is, I think, 84, and he is extremely ill. He probably will be gone in a year or so. The Crown Prince Sultan has been in and out of hospitals for 9 months. He spent several months here, and indeed King Abdullah himself booked the entire floor of the New York Presbyterian Hospital for a whole month. So basically, this is a very old generation of the Saudi royal family. It does have a new generation, but the new generation, the youngest among those, is like 65. It's probably the current foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal. So there isn't really a young generation in there. And when you really get to the young generation that needs to be empowered, they are very unhappy. with this very aging, paralyzed old regime. It's not only about letting women drive cars. It's about letting women exist to begin with. It's a truly medieval regime with no alternative vision. Now, that's juxtaposed with a very young population that has become extremely wealthy over the years of oil production since the 70s. It's on the internet. It's connected to the world. It's gone to UCLA and Berkeley and Columbia and Harvard and so on and so forth, and just comes back home to find it cannot relate to that country at all. Now, that's only in Saudi Arabia. The other thing that has happened to Saudi Arabia, which is important to consider when we look at the situation, is it has suddenly found itself frighteningly alone. Its biggest friend in the region, its other axis of power partner, Egypt, has had a revolution. And as you have read today and probably yesterday and in the past few days, the Saudi king was calling Barack Obama almost every day, saying, you've got to allow the Egyptian police to shoot and kill those people and stop telling them not to do that because they cannot take power. And, in fact, the Saudi king has canceled Hillary Clinton's visit to Saudi Arabia, which came out today in the newspaper, because he feels slighted by the refusal of the United States to abide by his decision. In fact, we did not really support the Egyptian revolution, but we couldn't go so far as to tell the Egyptian police, go ahead and kill your people. And besides, the issue was not in our hand. We basically were out of the picture.
But
that's the kind of mentality you're dealing with. You're dealing with a regime that considers merely the only form of dialogue in Saudi Arabia is to present petitions. You present a petition to the local prince. You present a petition to the governor. Basically, Saudi Arabian royal family has reduced its people to beggars who are given their rights as a favor.
So if this is the mentality of the king in terms of his advice to Barack Obama vis-a-vis Mubarak shooting his own people, presumably the king of Saudi Arabia and the royal family would shoot their people at the drop of a hat.
Well, what's more important, Ian, now is, are they going to shoot Bahraini people?
Well, I think, though, if we broaden this out a little, Yusuf Ibrahim, isn't this playing into the Iranian regime, which is not particularly popular at home, but if the Saudis and the Bahrainis resort to this kind of sectarian wedge tactic and start brutalizing or killing the Shiite majority in Bahrain, won't the Iranian regime be able to use this as a rallying call to get some more legitimacy at home by saying, we've got to stand up for our co-religionous brothers?
You're absolutely right, but I like to widen the scenario in a dramatic fashion, I'm going to make you bet that this is exactly what's going to happen in the next few weeks. There is a large party of people inside the ruling regime in Iran who are today celebrating. They are the happiest people on the face of the earth. They have gotten exactly what they want, which is Saudi forces coming into Bahrain, which is basically their oyster. They have a huge amount of influence inside Bahrain. They have the natural affinity of their Shiite brethren there only by virtue of the faith. And they have a natural sympathy, of course, for people in of their religious faith who are being persecuted because of their religious faith by Saudis, of all people. But what's more important, they have a Saudi army that is probably the most hapless, inefficient, unable to fight, never fought before army in the Arab world. And they are waiting for them to really start playing with them. And this is exactly what the Saudis have presented them with now. You will see, as you saw in Iraq, where the Iranians were able form a gigantic network of Shiite cells and underground fighters, which harassed the United States Army very seriously. In fact, half of our casualties in Iraq were caused by Iranian-trained Shiite fighters.
Well, thanks to George W. Bush, the Iranians have effectively ended up with Iraq.
Exactly. And in fact, so that's the picture you're looking at, Ian. You're looking at Iraq, which is a majority Shiite-ruled country, naturally sympathizing with those Shiites inside Saudi Arabia and certainly sympathizing with the Shiites in Bahrain. And of course, the Iraqis are really angry because the Iranians for years now have been sending Sunni fighters inside Iraq to kill Shiites. So there is a revenge element waiting here to happen. There is Hezbollah in Lebanon, which of course is Shiite and not at all sympathetic to the Saudis, and in fact has defeated the Saudis supported. So basically, you have what the Saudis did is put a fire to a sectarian divide that didn't really need any more gasoline poured over it.
Again, speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who was the New York Times senior regional Middle East correspondent for 18 years and has spent a number of the last years in the Gulf. The Saudi regime have to feel also, not only are they alone because they lost their biggest supporter in the neighborhood, Hosni Mubarak, they also, the government they backed in Lebanon just fell to Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy. So do you think that Bahrain could become another Beirut?
I think this is where we're heading. Of course, it's much more serious Beirut, because Beirut, people can continue to kill each other, but the vital interest of the United States and the vital interest of what we call the West, i.e. oil and economy, is not directly involved.
And the Fifth
However,
Fleet.
However, in
the
that region, it is.
But I'm saying that you're alluding to the Fifth Fleet, right?
And the Fifth Fleet is there, of course, but the example we have given in Libya is that we can have an entire armada and the order we're giving it is to do nothing. So I suspect, looking at President Obama's current policy, that he will not want to. What he will simply do is order the Fifth Fleet to leave instead of to engage. However, we are supporting the King of Bahrain. How we're supporting him is not very clear.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that given that Gates at least tried to give the King what seems like sensible advice, and I don't know that the Saudis would take our advice. So is there any possibility of them being a little more enlightened, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, and giving some baby steps or more than baby steps towards some kind of constitutional monarchy before they end up being driven out of town?
Yeah, and I think we're long past that point, not only in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, in the entire Middle East. In effect, when you think of it, and I'm sure you'll agree with that, the Egyptian revolution, which is, 3 weeks old already, 4 weeks old, is only beginning. They're already now beginning in the second phase, which hauling Mubarak into trials and arresting a thousand people, at least, supreme businessmen, allies of Mubarak and his kids, are being arrested. This is only the second phase of the Egyptian revolution, and it's only beginning now. What we are looking at in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia is not the beginning of phase one, is the introduction to phase one. I think we are going to have, for us as journalists, this is in many ways very exciting. For the people of the region, it is the moment of truth.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You can leave comments, and I'd love to hear from you. I'll be back again tomorrow for another background briefing. Bye for now.